You've seen our guest on Huffington Post, on CNN, all over broadcast TV, the interwebs, social media. He's been doing the rounds, and we're very fortunate to have Ali Rizvi, the author of the book, The Atheist Muslim, A Journey from Religion to Reason.
I'm thrilled to have you on. You know, you're someone who I've been paying attention to for, God, the last few years, really. And, you know, I've seen you on a number of interviews, and, you know, once Mike and I had this forum, you were someone who I'd wanted to reach out to for quite some time to get you on board. And part of the reason that I wanted to get you on board is your journey, or kind of your message, resonates with me. Like, I've gone through down that same kind of path. Mm-hmm. Where I'm curious, do you, when you're defining, you know, when you use the term atheist, people use it in different ways. How do you define atheism?
So I actually wrote that in the book, as you probably know, is that atheism to me is just a lack of belief in anything without evidence. So there's two different, I mean, A means without, theos means God, right? So one of the definitions can be without God. On the other hand, there's also theism, which refers to a personal God. So it can also refer to lack of belief in a personal God, in which sense deism, right, where deists actually believe in a non-personal God that does not intervene in our lives. So deists are also, in a way, atheists in that way, because they don't mm-hmm. believe in a personal God. So, I mean, we can get into the etymology of it, but sure. As far as I'm concerned, I was raised in a Muslim background with the Islamic religion, and I actually don't have any, I don't have any belief in God or any religion.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to ask that question, Ali, is, you know, you hear a lot of people describe themselves as either an atheist or agnostic, and at times, you know, those two terms seem to be interchangeable, or people kind of bounce back and forth. And someone who's obviously put a lot of thought into this, mm-hmm. years of thought, you know, for people who may be just listening to this now or watching this video, just to kind of get a baseline of where you are, I just thought might be important.
Mm-hmm. So here's the thing. Like, I don't necessarily consider agnosticism and atheism to be contradictory. So most atheists I know are also agnostic. And let me just explain what that means. So agnosticism, the word agnostic addresses knowledge, whether you know or not. Atheism refers to belief, whether you believe or not. So, for instance, if you ask a religious person, supposing you ask my mom, do you believe in God? She'll say, yes, I believe in God. If you ask her, do you know for sure there is a God? She'll say no. So she's an agnostic theist. Whereas with mm-hmm. me, if you ask me, do I believe in God? I would say, no, I don't believe in God. But if you ask me if I know if there's a God or not, I'll tell you that, no, I don't. I can't say for sure. I don't know for sure. So in that sense, I'm an agnostic atheist.
Right.
So one,
okay.
So that's clear? Like, one refers to knowledge, the other beliefs, the other refers to belief.
That's perfect. I just mm-hmm. always hear them interchanged so often, and they kind of bounce back and forth. So what was the first time that you... What was it like the first time that you truly intellectually defined yourself to someone as an atheist? Like that moment where you go, okay, I'm going to say it. Was that a heavy moment?
I don't know if it was one moment. I did go through that whole thing where, you know, I was kind of, I like to say agnostic. The connotation we have in society with the word atheist is just, you know, these firebrand, arrogant people who claim certainty. They just seem to know that, okay, yeah, everything that came out of here, you know, I don't believe that there was a God. I believe nothing created it. But that's not actually what atheism is. Atheism is the opposite of that. It's an acknowledgement that we don't know, and that we're not going to believe something unless we have evidence for it, until we know about it. So atheism is actually a more humble position. The more arrogant and firebrand position is to have a claim on truth, say, well, I know there's a one true God, and, you know, this is the word of God, and we have to follow it to a letter. That's the arrogance, right? So mm-hmm. so being a theist and being a believing theist is actually more of an arrogant position than atheism. So I didn't want to be associated with the word atheist for the longest time because of these connotations that it had. But now I think that it's important to own the word and to normalize it. And it shouldn't be a necessary word. I mean, to paraphrase Sam Harris, who's also, you know, a famous atheist writer, you know, he says that, you know, you don't have astrologers and non-astrologers. You know, you just have regular people and you have people who believe in astrology. So we shouldn't really need the word atheism, but considering the majority of the world seems to be religious and have some sort of belief in the supernatural, it's a necessary word. The thing that I like about the word, as opposed to other words like humanist and so on, is that it's a lack of belief. So it by definition can't be dogmatic. You know, people can be dogmatic humanists. I mean, communism was a form of dogmatic humanism, and it came from, you know, belief in humans as a center of everything, and it was pretty much like a religion in that sense. So the good thing about atheism is that it unburdens you from any of those issues.
Right, but there was never a moment at like a family party where you knew there were certain traditions that were happening, and there was that moment where you had to go, all right, I'm going to stake my claim, that you didn't have that kind of public coming, that private but public coming out among family and friends.
Yeah, I never did it with the word. I always said that I don't believe in the stuff, and the thing with me is, and I write this in the book, I have a family that's a relatively moderate to liberal Muslim family. So in a way, they're actually a lot more liberal and pro-secular than many fundamentalist Christians. So I used to go, I still am involved in, just like, you know, a lot of atheists on Christmas, you know, they celebrate Christmas. They do the whole Easter bunny thing with the eggs with their kids, even though that has nothing to do with Jesus. But you know, so I like the Eid celebrations. Eid is like the Muslim Christmas. I like that in Ramadan, the month of fasting, there are the feasts. So I might have a beer with my fast, and I may not fast. I tell people I fast 3 times a day between meals.
We're big fasters on this show, Ali. We think fasting is a very important health component. So you're talking to two fasters, year-round fast. Well, wait, you're not a full-time faster, are you, Jones? I'm a faster. You're not a faster.
No, I was fasting today. I fast every day.
Right.
I intermittent fast every day.
Good. See?
Not
all right.
For religious purposes.
Yeah. All right.
But just to keep this svelte figure.
Right.
Intermittent fasting is, I mean, that's another thing. I was actually talking about the religious fasting.
Right.
I think intermittent fasting is a really good thing. If we were talking about health, that would be a different issue. I'd be more embarrassed since I'm on my third love handle already, but I have to do something about it. However, we're talking about the fasting of Ramadan. So I'd engage in the feasts, and I'd be there for the parties and, you know, all the my nephews and nieces and the family. And I like that. But in those parties in my family, I can actually say they all know I'm an atheist. You know, so I would typically just say, well, I don't believe in the religious part. I don't believe in God. I don't do that. I'm here for the food.
Right. And so aren't there important components to religion that, you know, they have a place in your life? In other words, isn't religion really just a life system anyway? And so we adhere to the fasting, and we could say it's for Jesus or for Allah or for whatever, but we just think it's for health. And other people do it for religious reasons, but isn't there a religious, you know, reason for very sensible, reasonable things that we should be doing anyway?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of good. I mean, I always talk about this. And in Islam, one thing that I really like is actually one of the five pillars in Sunni Islam. It's called zakah, which is a charity where a percentage of your income every year is donated to the poor. I think that's a wonderful system. And you know, I actually find religion a lot more fascinating since I stopped believing, because it's a great window into the way that people used to think and just the evolution of the human mind and how they used to, you know, inquire and how they used to find answers. I think it's obsolete. And I think that now you don't have to be religious to do any of that. It's not necessary for it. I mean, all of those things, the charity and the health and the medicine, I mean, it's much, much more advanced now than it was when these religions were in vogue. And there are many atheists and agnostics who there's nothing that they do that religious people don't do, right, in that sense.
So you're still basically adhering to religion, just without believing there's actually going to be a God who greets you after you leave this earthly dimension.
Well, let's differentiate between religion and faith, right? So as I said, you know, religion is a fascinating topic. It's great to look into. When all of us read about Greek mythology, I found it fascinating, right? Nordic mythology, I found it fascinating. I found all of those stories, you know, from Prometheus to Zeus and Hera, all of that. Hindu mythology, even Christian mythology, all of these things have been, they're very interesting academically, and there are lessons in them. It's like, you know, the fables in the Bible and the fables in the Quran, which are very similar, are kind of like, you know, the Mother Goose. Every story has a moral. There's a reason that they were written. That's one thing, to be interested in religion and to have, you know, a lot of traditions, a lot of the art and the culture, cultural history that we have. Is all rooted in, you know, if you go to the Vatican, you've got some of the most amazing art there. And it's all, you know, it's, if you don't understand religion, Christianity, the history of Christianity, you're not going to be able to appreciate it fully. So there are those elements. Going back even further, the word Thursday, the day Thursday, is from Thor. We all say Thursday. We say goodbye. Goodbye means God be with you. That's where it came from. So there are these elements there that we still have. Having faith and to believe that that is the truth, and that's how you should live your life, and that people who don't live their lives will not be saved, or they'll be, you know, doomed to eternal hellfire, or you know, they should be killed or punished, or, you know, something like that. That the faith aspect of it, to me, is much more dangerous. And that's why I make a distinction, the book actually makes a distinction between Islamic ideology, the dangers of Islamic ideology, and differentiates that from Muslim identity, you know, which is a completely different thing. And it has a completely different definition now than it did 1400 years ago.
Now, Ali, do you ever miss being religious? I know you struggled at an early age with it. But do you ever have, and the reason I ask it is because I'll admit, you know, over the years, I've looked at the way I was raised. I don't believe those same, I was raised Irish Catholic. I don't believe those same things anymore. But like that comfort zone that was there, I will tell anybody, I completely miss it. If I could somehow flip and get myself back into that like little nest again, I think I would do it. Because there was some structure, some mechanism there that was, I found very comforting for me. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel that way? Or did you ever, you know, in those first years where you were really, truly a thinking, identifying atheist, where you kind of were like, oh, maybe if I could flip the script, that was a nice little cocoon.
The faith part of it, I actually don't miss at all. But so there are two aspects to this, that question and the answer I'm about to give is that there is a faith aspect. Do I miss that? No, it just made me feel guilty. It made me feel terrified all the time. I always thought I was doing something wrong. It was just, I mean, well, with Catholicism, you probably know that all too well, right?
Mm-hmm, it's, absolutely.
The guilt. But the community aspect now in my situation, I have an exceptional situation among most Muslims, right? I'll be the first to acknowledge it. As I said, my family is very sort of liberal, pro-secular. So I haven't lost my family because of it. I can still, you know, I can still go back for Eid celebrations and Ramadan celebrations, just like, you know, you may be able to go back for Christmas and spend that with your family.
Sure.
Without any sort of religious faith-based element to it, right? So I can do that. A lot of people, but you're right. Those things, the community aspect of it, the family aspect of it, that part of it, ex-Muslims or people who were in the Muslim faith and then gave it up, who came from more conservative religious families, which I would say is the majority, they have suffered terribly for it. So here in the West, a lot of I know a lot of young people who were from Islamic families, the moment they left their faith, they were ostracized. They were disowned from their families, and they had to basically make it on their own. It's worse in Muslim majority countries. And you know, I grew up until I was in my 20s. I was in Libya and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and these Muslim majority countries. And over there, people have been. There's a guy, Mashal Khan, in Pakistan, who was beat, and he was beaten to death by hundreds of his students in a university in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. There's Raif Badawi, who's a friend of mine, who's a blogger. He just wrote about secularism, not even atheism, and he's in jail in Saudi Arabia, and he's sentenced to 1,000 lashes, and he's in jail for 10 years. And I just saw his kids last month, and I met with his wife last month, and you know, they live here in Canada, and it's horrible what they're going through, that separation. They haven't seen their father for 5 years. So there are for them, many of those people that I know, and I'll give you one more example, is I host a podcast called Secular Jihadists from the Middle East. And one of my co-hosts is Yasmin Mohammed. And Yasmin Mohammed was married. She grew up in Canada wearing the, you know, the niqab and the, you know, the ninja suit with the eyes and everything. And very, very ultra conservative, what they call Salafist Islamic household. When she was 20 years old, she was forced into a marriage to an Al-Qaeda militant who is now in jail in Egypt. And she eventually busted out of that. Now she's an atheist. She hosts a podcast with us. But if you ask her, she doesn't really miss a whole lot of the religious aspect. She's not a fan of – I mean, they're, just as I was in Ramadan, I'm able to enjoy the meals. There are a lot of other kids who grew up and they were forced to starve by their parents during Ramadan. So for me, I have the freedom, and I am fortunate to be in the minority of ex-Muslims who can go back and still take part in these traditions, and still my family still accepts me. But for most of them, it's not something that they really miss.
And in Libya, was that a fairly Western country? Obviously, before we went in and wrecked it. Of the three countries you lived in, the Muslim countries you lived in, that was probably the more lenient or tolerant. Do I have that correct?
Compared to Saudi Arabia and compared to Pakistan, yes. And I was very young when I was there. So, you know, we're talking late 70s, early 80s. But I do remember it was a very sort of, like, you know, Gaddafi was a big fan of socialism at the time. So he, you know, we had, you know, stuff. We had to go get a certain amount of eggs and a certain amount of milk and, you know, things like that. So it was a, it was definitely less religious than anything else. But it still had the same taboos that most Muslim majority countries do, where, you know, you can't really criticize religion. So.
And so, how did your family that's kind of liberal? How did they? Mm-hmm. Deal with living in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia?
Well, my family's originally, I mean, my family's from Pakistan. So they, my mother is a university professor. She used to find it infuriating, particularly living in Saudi Arabia, because of their women can't drive. And she had to cover her hair. She had to wear a black cloak when she was out in public. Even, you know, she taught university students, but you know, she couldn't drive herself to work, so she had to deal with much less educated, you know, much less intelligent people, men, while she had to be covered up, and she was considered inferior. And she had, in Saudi Arabia, they have a system of male guardianship, where you have to get permission from your husband or your father to travel, to step out of the house, to work. You have to have written permission. And that's obviously something that did not sit well with her either. So she found it very frustrating there. If you're, you know, all of these places, they did have their frustrations. Since my parents weren't really very vocal about religion, they just kind of, it was just in the back of their minds. They just kind of lived their lives as people would. They were more comfortable in Pakistan because they had family and so on. But it was tough. It's not easy living in those societies.
And now when you were in Saudi Arabia, in your family, you know, there's this separation really between the Saudi royal family and then really how the rest of the country operates. And you can tell me if I, you know, if I'm off on this, but any kind of books that I've read about the Saudi royal family, I've come away from it kind of feeling as though they're secularists, they're atheists, and that this is kind of a tool. Well, that this is really a tool, you know, this kind of handing over religion to Wahhabism and to have kind of the Wahhabi leadership kind of cut the hammer to everyone's anvil. Is there any thought among Saudi people, like inside Saudi Arabia, where that would almost foster some thoughts of atheism or where someone would challenge a concept of God, where you would really see the family that, you know, rules the country kind of handing over the keys to these people who really just seem to be imprisoning them with, you know, religious rules. Is there any thought among Saudi people where they would look at the juxtaposition of the way the Saudi royal family lives and the way the Wahhabi hierarchy kind of lord over the masses and go, well, wait a minute, there's something missing here.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good and very insightful question. And this is something that a lot of people don't know about Saudi Arabia. So a lot of the, it's really interesting. So the Saudi population, obviously, there are many different kinds of people in Saudi Arabia. When I was growing up there, a lot of people were frustrated with the royal family because they thought the royal family was too liberal. You know, they had music on TV. A lot of the people thought music was a sin. So in a lot of ways, the population was a lot more conservative religiously than the royal family itself. And they did not like the indulgences. Of course, they couldn't say it. You know, you can't speak. They couldn't even say it to me or talk about it amongst themselves because, you know, anybody who gets reported, you know, it's a dictatorship, but they just whisk you off in the middle of the night. You'd never be heard from again. So it's very hard to find out what people really think over there. But the other point that you mentioned is very important. A lot of these Muslim majority countries, the dictatorships especially, they tend to be the dictators tend to be more secular, relatively. That doesn't mean they're completely secular. It's not enlightenment type secular, but they're threatened by religion. I mean, the only thing that actually brings them down eventually, the only opposition that's actually organized is the religious groups. You know, and you see this in Iran when you have the Shah of Iran who was very secular and he came down, the religious orthodoxy came and took hold. We're seeing it happen in Syria. You know, the only organized opposition is the religious orthodoxy in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood came to power after Mubarak stepped down. So this is something that happens over and over again. So the biggest threat to them is people who become too religious, because that can actually overpower them, can make them, it can take the fear out of them. On the other hand, they also want to use religion to control the masses and to take the power away from them in a way and manipulate them. And one example of this, you gave the Saudi example, where, you know, they do have a religious police called the Mutawa. So the Saudi royal family essentially outsources, you know, all of their control of the people to them. And these are people who just go around the streets and they see if there's a woman without her hair covered, they'll take her off to the Mutawa station, or a guy talking to a girl, same kind of thing, intermingling of the sexes and so on. But
wasn't there even a week ago, I think I saw, wasn't there just a 14-year-old boy that did the Macarena in the middle of an intersection? Cars were stopped and he just jokingly did the Macarena and he was taken away.
Yeah. They take people away. There was the girls who are not wearing covering their hair. You know, they take them away, and they actually use the religion to keep people under control. But if you get too religious and your beard becomes too long, then you become a threat. And another really good example of how this works is in Pakistan a few years ago. Remember when they had the Innocence of Muslims video that, you know, eventually it was related to the Benghazi attack and so on.
Yes.
And they said it was triggered by it, and we don't really know if it was or not. So, but in any case, so there was a blasphemy issue. So what the Pakistani government did was it banned YouTube. Like, we're going to ban YouTube all over the country. Nobody's allowed to watch YouTube. They took it off the internet, or they just blocked it on the internet. And they said that it was because YouTube was hosting blasphemous videos and it wouldn't take them off. They were insulting to the prophet of Islam, insulting to the religion. Now, how do they benefit? They benefited because YouTube and Twitter and all these social media platforms are actually how their political opposition can speak out. So by doing that, by getting rid of YouTube, they're kind of quashing a major platform for their political opponents. But if they say that, then the whole country would rise up against them.
So is that Ali, do you think that's an example?
When they say it's blasphemy, then the whole country's with them, right? The whole country supports it. So that's an example of how they use it to manipulate.
That video did not cause Benghazi, right? I mean, it was ridiculous. But is this an example of, the mayor of Chicago is named Rahm Emanuel. Are you familiar with this character?
Yeah.
He famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Is it possible, when countries are blocking YouTube under the guise of nonsense like that, are they taking advantage of a crisis and just leveraging a situation? Or was this thing a plant from the beginning to aid a whole lot of interests? The Muslim theocracies were able to use it to their advantage. The West, obviously, we had a nice little scapegoat to cover up whatever the hell was going on at Benghazi. Is that my tinfoil hat on, or are they that devious?
I think it's a little more complicated than that. I don't think it was a deliberate plant. That might be a little bit of the foil hat. But I think that because there's a lot of people who make these videos, a lot of people are speaking out about it. I think the guy who made the video genuinely meant it. He was just, and it was a very poorly made video too.
Terrible.
You would think that if it was a plant, it would have been a little better. But it just happened to be convenient at the time. So it was there. It was convenient. And, you know, whoever wanted to use it at the time, the Pakistani government used it. You know, I think both sides and on the Benghazi issue exploited that whole issue. So there's they do use these things. I don't think they're necessarily planted, but, you know, there are loads of videos like that. You can just grab any one of them. You can use it any way you want to. But I do think that these governments tend to, because the masses are so sensitive to blasphemy. Blasphemy is such a sensitive issue among the Muslim masses in most Muslim majority countries, even in the more sort of moderate ones, that it's a very convenient tool for them to use. They can quash political opposition very easily, and they can blame it on blasphemy and look good in the process and get the people on their side.
Is there any chance, though, you know, within Pakistan or any of these countries, when they do that, and it doesn't even have to be a Muslim country, I'm wondering, you know, in any kind of country where all of a sudden YouTube becomes unavailable, like, for example, everyone was going through their September 11th anniversaries just the other day, but you do have people in this country that will go around and go, a building doesn't fall like that. Those were explosions. And their wheels are kind of turning in another direction. It may be impossible for you to handicap this, but would you have any idea what percentage of, say, people in Pakistan would go, oh, YouTube's not available? I know they're saying blasphemy, but there's something else at work.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of people. It's not the majority, but there are a significant amount of people. There are people who are, you got to remember, like, this is a huge, there's 50 countries, millions and millions of people who have all kinds of beliefs. The only ones that you hear about are the ones that are not going to get them killed. So you don't, because you see what happens to Raif, by the way, someone who speaks out, he ends up in jail. You know, the bloggers in Bangladesh who write openly, and Bangladesh is officially a secular country, officially. And they get hacked to death with machetes in the middle of the street in broad daylight. So, you know, you're not going to hear that point of view, but there are a lot of people who think that. And so in Saudi Arabia, we were talking about how, you know, the majority of people are very religiously conservative, but at the same time, a recent Gallup poll that was done, I think in 2013, 2014, I can't remember the exact year, showed that 19% of people in Saudi Arabia identify as non-religious and 5% say they're confirmed atheists. So 5%. So for comparison, that 5% is that's the same percentage as in the U.S. that say that they're confirmed atheists. 19% non-religious. In Italy, that percentage is 15% in the same survey.
Wow.
So, and you know, and these numbers are probably underreported. You know, there've been 10 million downloads of the Arabic version of The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins in Saudi Arabia. Last 10 years, I've been hearing from people in Saudi Arabia, atheists in Saudi Arabia who are closeted, who can't speak out. A lot of them, they won't even tell me what their names are. So, yes, there are skeptics and there are atheists and there are dissidents in all of these countries. You just don't hear that narrative. And the unfortunate thing is if they the same things that they say over there, what Raif Badawi's in jail for, if he came to the U.S., they'd call him Islamophobic.
You know? Right.
So they're kind of
how crazy is that?
It's crazy. It's like, you know, if Voltaire and Rousseau and all these Enlightenment thinkers, if they were all called Christianophobic, you know, and worse, the people who call them Islamophobic here. Right, or mainly a lot of Western liberals, the apologetics, they're the ones who are benefiting from the Enlightenment that happened, you know, in the history of Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. That whole the really bloody reform movement that led to Enlightenment thinkers and people like Jefferson and Locke and Voltaire and Rousseau, and they actually brought us the secularism and the freedom and the liberty and everything, everything we enjoy here in the Western world. We're the beneficiaries of people like that. Now we're taking the same people, you know, when it's happening over in the Muslim world, and we're disowning them, you know?
And do you feel Islam is in the, to draw that parallel, in the Christianity Inquisition era, and we're on the precipice of a reformation within Islam? Is that even possible?
Yeah, I think it is possible. And this is, I actually went into some detail in the book, and I talked about some press, obviously, Christianity is a different religion, Judaism is a different religion. I mean, these are, they have differences with Islam, but the parallels are actually a lot more relevant, I think. And even if we just look back a few decades and we look at the Salman Rushdie incident when he wrote the Satanic Verses in the late 80s, early 90s, and there was a fatwa, death sentence upon him. And he had to go into hiding, and he was just moving from house to house for years. He was even forced to lie and say that he accepted Islam at one point. Nobody believed it, thankfully. And if you look at him now he's on TV shows. He's everywhere. Right. I mean, there are loads of – you had the Muhammad cartoons as you know, just about 11 years ago in Denmark, and there was a furor over them. Now if you go online, there are – thousands and thousands of Muhammad cartoons. And so there's a, I mean, we're hosting this podcast. I'm talking to you the way that I am. And this isn't something that would have happened 20, 30 years ago, but it's already, it is happening. So I wouldn't say we're in the middle of it, but I think we're at the beginning of it. And so Maryam Namazi is, she's an Iranian ex-Muslim who founded the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. And she said that the printing, what the internet is doing for Islam, is what the printing press did for Christianity in the past. So it's not something. I think reform in Islam is something that we're already seeing happening. I mean, we're already seeing people come out and talk about it. I've written a book about it. There are people like Ayan Hirsi-Ali on the conservative side who have written books about it. There is, Maryam Namazi, who's talking about it very openly. There are conferences happening everywhere. There are podcasts. More and more people in the Arab world and the Muslim world at large are coming out. They talk to us openly. We've recently talked to a guy who was considering joining ISIS, and he was in Jordan. He's surrounded by people who have been recruited by ISIS. He even deconverted them from Islam.
Wow.
And it's a great episode. His name is Muhammad Al-Qadra. He spoke to us from Jordan openly. This is something that, you know, that wasn't imaginable just a few years ago, but it's happening all over the place right now. So I think that there's still a lot of horrible stuff out there. So I don't want to downplay the danger of people who come out and speak openly, but it's happening a lot more than it did even 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible that Salman Rushdie overreacted? Like, you feel like things are easier now than they were 30 years ago? Because I it would seem like most people feel like, you know, the media has whipped them into a fervor to be fearful of Muslims and Islam and terrorism and fundamentalism and all of this, where I really don't feel that way at all. I think it's all some sort of propaganda to fuel these wars. I don't think there's anything to fear by speaking out, at least in these Western countries, maybe not in Riyadh, but do you feel like Salman, he really was threatened 30 years ago?
Two parts of it. That's a very good question. So two parts of it. One part I disagree with. I don't think that Salman Rushdie overreacted at all. I was in Saudi Arabia at the time. I was also going back and forth to Pakistan. And even in Britain, you know, I have relatives in Britain. I have first cousins and aunts and uncles there. And he was under very, very serious threat of death, even in the UK. And this is... We know this about the Danish cartoons, the cartoonists, right? We know this about Theo van Gogh, you know, the man who made the submission film with Ion Hersey-Ali, who stabbed to death. We know this with all the terrorist incidents and, you know, people trying to kill infidels. This has been, like, this is a serious threat. However, at the same time, there is an overreaction, I think, here now. I think what we do is, I mean, if you look at it, we've gone from an organized international terrorist organization, right? Flying planes into skyscrapers, bringing down the World Trade Center. We've gone from that in 16 years to now these sort of lone people acting on their own, just inspired by Anwar al-Awlaki videos on the internet and driving cars into crowds and killing a few people here and there. Now, of course, it's a horrible thing. Even one person who dies from a terrorist attack is too much. But if you look at the scale of things and how, you know, compared to then to now, I mean, there's definitely been an improvement. We've done our job. We haven't just done this, you know, sort of militarily, and but we've done it through dialogue as well. I mean, there are a lot of people having conversations that they didn't have before. The overreaction aspect, I've done this on several times when I've talked, and I would quote Yuval Noah Harari, who's a writer in, you know, he's a professor in Israel who wrote Sapiens, and he also wrote Homo Deus recently. And he said that terrorism, the way that terrorism works is it's not the bull in the China shop that goes and destroys the China shop. It's a fly that's or the mosquito buzzing in the ear of the bull that drives it so insane that the bull overreacts and then goes and destroys the China shop. And the reason I thought of that is because recently Theresa May, who's the Prime Minister of the UK, talked about, she actually tweeted that if we have to change our human rights laws for more security, I'm willing to change our human rights laws. And this is a problem because that is what they want. When we start cannibalizing the very fundamental, the most important core values that we have of, you know, liberty and human rights, and we decide to compromise on them, right? And those are the exact same things that we're under attack for by these guys, then they've won, right? Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they want. So in that sense, I do think that there is an overreaction. There are these two extremes on the left. There's a complete denial that there's anything happening. You know, it has nothing to do with Islam. You know, you're a bigot if you even talk about it. And on the right, there is this overreaction, as you're saying, where, you know, yeah, we're willing to compromise our human rights, you know, the civil liberties. Well, you know, there's this whole other issue. And the problem with both sides is that they don't differentiate between Islam as a religion, which is a set of ideas in a book, doesn't have feelings, doesn't have rights, and Muslims as people who are human beings, who are diverse, who have... You know, there are people like me. There's, you know, all kinds of different people. There are a lot of American Muslims who are actually not much different from you guys, right? So there's and they conflate the two. On the left, they say that if you criticize Islam, you're a bigot against all Muslims. So you can't even criticize Islam. On the right, they say that, well, there are a lot of problems with Islam. So anybody who says he's a Muslim must believe in all of these things, right? And both of those things are false. You know, they're two different things.
Now, do you, you know, all these ideas that you're speaking and that we're discussing, I mean, these are very radical things for, you know, mm-hmm. For many people to have a discussion about, particularly a Muslim or an ex-Muslim. What has been feedback? Because I know, you know, you have a large community of people that you reach out to. Sarah Hayter is someone who comes to mind. But I think of her in particular. What has been, you know, I look at you and I think to myself, like, you know, we're talking about Salman Rushdie. And, you know, did you ever feel like you were under threat at any point for ideas? Would you ever be concerned? But moreover, even to, do you know what kind of the reaction is among your female atheist Muslim peers?
That's again, a really good question. It's a very different experience for the women, the ex-Muslim mm-hmm. women, than it is for men. The thing is, unfortunately, the threat is real. Unfortunately, I have gotten death threats. Unfortunately, I do have to be careful. Luckily, I'm in Canada, so it's not that. But we have had to report threats to the police here mm-hmm. at times. There was a conference I was speaking at in New York, and someone sent me a map of Manhattan, or the area where we were going to speak. So we had to get police security. I've had to get armed security at talks that I've done in different places. So, you know, the threat, unfortunately, even here in the West, is still real. It's nothing like it, obviously, it would be in Saudi Arabia or even in a lot of places in Europe. Canada's a lot better, but it is real. With the women, it's worse because, you know, my wife's also a sort of secular Pakistani, you know, feminist activist. And the threats that I get are just, you know, we're going to kill you. Wait till the next time you come here or we're there. You know, we're going to do this and send you a map of where you're speaking and so on. With her, it's rape threats. They're all sexualized.
Really?
It's like, I'll put a gun in your vagina. Like, I'm going to do this to you, do that. And it's amazing. She actually supported a sort of pro-secular candidate in Pakistan, and she just posted on Facebook that, you know, I support this candidate. I think this is a good direction for him to go. And within an hour and a half, you know, we had something like 140 rape threats and death threats from there. We didn't know how many of them were from the West. I doubt a lot of them were, but we actually had to go and we had to report them all here in Canada to law enforcement. So it's a very different experience for women, and this happens, I think, generally with conservative, you know, the conservative religious communities everywhere, that there's this idea that, you know, religion is morality. So a woman who decides to let go of religion is now immoral. So you mm-hmm. know, she is she's probably going to be promiscuous. She'll, you know, she'll have no limits, and you know, that sort of control that Abrahamic religions have tried to have over women to keep them down, you know, suddenly that's been lifted, and that becomes a very threatening thing. I mean, even a woman getting education, 14-year-old girl who's advocating for girls going to school, Malala Yousafzai, is shot in the head. That is right. A threat to them, right? So it is the issue of women is a very big one. Not only, I mean, it's in Islam specifically, you know, because with the honor killings and the FGM and Malala getting shot in the head, but also generally in all the Abrahamic religious traditions.
And I'm worried about the women. I'm worried about the women, Jones, but I'm more worried about you and I, Jones. Ali, have we made a mistake by Skyping with you tonight? If I agree not to drive for a year, will they let me off the hook?
Sorry, if you agree what?
Not to drive for a year, will they let me off the hook? Have I made a mistake?
Well, you know what? You're a white infidel, and that's all that matters.
And goddamn right I am. Ali.
Ali.
Yeah, go ahead, Jones. The witness is yours, Jones.
Right. No, I'm just curious, just based on what you had just been saying just a moment ago, why do you feel, what is your opinion, your take, why mankind needs religion? What do you feel the attraction is, and why it's such a driving force, and why I even look back on it in my current state and I go, man, if I could take the different pill, man, I'd go back.
It was all bullshit, but somehow it made me feel better at night.
Yeah, what is that?
We have a fear of the unknown. There's a, you know, as you said it yourself, there's a comfort level that we have unanswered questions. You know, from the beginning of time, there was a time when all these religions came around. You know, I say now my 7-year-old niece knows more about the carbon cycle than Muhammad or Jesus or any of these guys did. I mean, these are questions that they asked. They didn't understand what the stars were about, what the moon was about, the planets. They didn't know any of this stuff. They didn't know where right. this world came from. Eclipses. They didn't know what would happen. Yeah, they didn't know what would happen after they died. They didn't want to die. It's a human instinct to, you know, want it. It's actually the instinct of all of life to survive, right? So we have, I wrote about this in the book too. When I was a kid at school, I remember I used to run after ants, you know, like the insects, not the mm-hmm. women. Ants are all very nice. I love them a lot, but the ants, the ants, and I used to run after them, and they could hear the stomping. They would scurry away. They knew that something bad was coming. They had this self-preservation instinct where they wanted to survive, but they didn't have the central nervous systems that we do that would consciously make them aware that they're trying to survive. So we have the same instinct to survive and the same self-preservation instinct that the insects do, but at the same time we have the central nervous system that's complicated and that's complex enough and intricate enough to understand that we will all die one day, and that's a huge conflict. And I think religion actually gave people that. They said there's this something out there that created all of this around you that you don't understand. It promises you all this stuff after life, after you die, something else you don't understand, and just kind of fills in the vacuum for you. And then it uses that to manipulate you into doing whatever it wants to. And there was a time when that was necessary. People needed it. And now we don't. Now we have much better explanations for everything that we see around us that just doesn't require religion. In fact, religion is antithetical to everything else that we know now. People still find comfort in it. It's been around for a very, very long time. I mean, religion's been around for tens of thousands of years. Scientific revolution, you know, happened in 400 years, maybe Kepler, Galileo. Mm-hmm. Like it's very young. But at the same time, if you look around, everybody lives. You know, everything that works, everything that we do is based on science. Science has made the world work in a way that religion never did. I mean, nothing else provided the kind of answers that science has provided recently. So it hasn't gotten to the point where people can get, you know, comfort from science and truth and reality, but you know, the sense of community. I mean, those things are still there, but it's just not as relevant as it was before.
Do you have any stress about the end, about death?
I am actually a trained pathologist. So what I did was I did a lot of autopsies during residency. Now I work in medical communications. I stopped clinical practice since I started writing. But so I used to do a lot of autopsies, and that's one of the things that made me sort of change my career and decide more to do what I want, is because I did have a fear of death for the longest time. And then I kind of faced up to it, and I would just see these people. And, you know, every time there was a body there, it was a naked body with, you know, a toe tag on a cold steel table. And I didn't know if they died happy. I didn't know if they died sad. I didn't know if they were billionaires or homeless. I don't know if they died surrounded by loved ones or completely alone. All I knew was that they were dead. And initially, that was scary. Now it doesn't bother me. It's actually more comforting for me to think of death as an atheist. 13.8 billion years ago, since the universe was created, from then until 1975, I was dead. I mean, I did not exist. All kinds of things happened. You know, dinosaurs came. You know, the Arabs discovered oil in the desert. know, it's a line from Airplane, one of my favorite movies.
Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah,
they did. You know, human beings went to the moon. You know, Kennedy was assassinated. I didn't know. Like, none of that stuff affected me until I showed up and I gained consciousness. And after I die, I'm going to go back to that same state again. That's actually comforting to me. You know, it seems like for me, I think it would be, if there was some sort of eternity, it used to scare me a lot more before, because there was heaven and hell, especially if you're Muslim or Catholic or, you know, one of these religions where, you know, the afterlife is very, very scary. It doesn't bother me at all.
You used the term before the universe was created, and I don't know if that was just the way your tongue worked there,
probably metaphorical,
right?
It's like scripture.
There's so much, you know, scientists have been so amazingly wrong so often. To place all your faith in science, to me, is almost, but I don't want to, you know, be an asshole, but as irrational as people who, from your perspective, place all of their faith in religion. Just because we don't know what created the universe doesn't mean the universe wasn't created by someone or something. So I guess, you know, what's going to happen to you after you die? Do you ever think about that? What projections can you make in your imagination?
The only thing I can think of is what I told you before, is what happened before I was born. I didn't say before the universe was created. I was like, since 13.8, wow. Since that universe came into being.
Okay, fine. You're cleaning it up, Ali.
But let's say it came into being. So let's just take...
Oh, we froze
just
up.
Get rid of the...
Here, hold on. Sorry, just go. So go ahead and say that again. There, we'll clean it up in post, buddy.
Okay, so I wasn't saying before the universe was created. I was saying from the start of the universe, 13.8 billion years ago.
All right.
Until it's 1975 when I was born. So that's one thing. But let's talk about the idea of having faith in science. So, it's about evidence. Right. So science is, let me give you an example, theory of gravity. Right. You have the law of gravity, which describes what gravity is. Then you have the theory of gravity that explains why gravity exists. Again, based on evidence and based on experiment. Newton had certain ideas, went on for about 300 years. Some of them were found to be it was eventually replaced by the general theory of relativity, which is the theory of gravity that we use today. It still retains some of what Newton said, and it has replaced part of what he said. So science is something that evolves. So, you know, if you have faith in Newton's science, then we wouldn't have changed. But science is based on falsifiability. It says, come here and prove me wrong. That's how it stands the test of time, the test of experiment. So that's one thing. So you don't have faith in science. You have evidence for scientific phenomena, and you go by that. That's one thing. Now, just to show you an example of, you know, when you talked about before the universe was created, there is a possibility, right? And again, this is not set in stone, but the Big Bang, right, which we actually have a lot more evidence for, had a lot more evidence that that happened compared to Let There Be Light in the Bible, for instance, which has no evidence. So the Big Bang was actually not only the beginning of matter in the universe, but it was also the beginning of time. That's when time and matter came into existence. So if it was a beginning of time, that meant that before the Big Bang doesn't make sense, because when there is no time, there is no before. If time doesn't exist, you can't have a before and after. And cause happens before effect. So without a before and after, without time, you don't have cause and effect. So that's why Stephen Hawking and all of these physicists say that's when at the point of the Big Bang is when cause and effect, the relationship between cause and effect, collapse. So that's an example. Again, is that true? Do we know that for sure? No, we don't. There's a lot of evidence that it could be true, and it's a possibility. And the fact that it's possible, to me, is a lot more convincing. I mean, not only the fact that the theory itself has a lot of evidence in support of it, but also that it acknowledges that it's just a possibility.
So, Ali, similar to how someone like me, a Catholic, would rely on faith, you're relying on, you know, scientific theories. And so I guess I'm going to expose myself. And not in the Carlos Danger Anthony Weiner way that is actually my want. I guess I don't understand the difference between a scientific theory and a law. Isn't a law a theory that has been proven so many times that it actually became a law? Refresh me on my fifth grade science, if you don't mind.
So this is one conflation that you're making that's actually a very common mistake. So
I fell back to the mean.
No, I'm not being mean. I'm just telling you it's a common mistake. The theories don't develop into laws, and laws don't become theories. So in science, laws and theories are two totally different things. So for example, the law of gravity, right, states the relationship between two bodies and how they attract each other. It simply is a description of what gravity is. The theory of gravity explains why the law happens, right? So the theory of evolution, for instance, right? Evolution is a fact, right? You can call it the law of evolution that, you know, we've all evolved from certain species, and that's something that we know for sure. Right? We know that now because of DNA. We've known it before because of the fossil record and so on. But the theory of evolution is something that explains how that happened or why that happened. Now, the reason it's called a theory is because it's never complete. We're going to keep on discovering things. Those things will not necessarily disprove the earlier theories. They'll just add to them. For instance, initially we had the fossil record, overwhelming amount of evidence, right, that evolution, that's how evolution happened. Then recently we had the molecular genetic revolution. And now we know from DNA studies between different species, right, that we all had a common ancestor about 4.5 billion years ago. And we actually know that beyond any doubt. And in the future, we may have further evidence that would be added to the theory. So theory is actually, in science, it has a very different definition than what it does in just normal layman's terms.
That's all well and fine, but we all know the Earth was made in 6 days, and then God watched football, Ali.
Beyond that.
We know, right. We know.
Yeah, but we can, 6 days.
And so
is the Earth flat? Can we squeeze that in there? Is the Earth flat, Ali? Is there any chance that the Earth is flat?
Is there any chance? You know what? I'm going to reserve comment on that.
Okay. I just thought I would throw that out there. I'd like to throw Mike and I like to throw the flat Earth thing in there. Just every once in a while. Because
both sides of the debate, right? Like it's important. The flat Earth and the non-flat Earth.
But the reason I ask it is because my favorite reaction is when you hit on a flat Earther who feels that they can come out to you and they do the Olay. And then they lean in.
I'm going to tell you something.
So I wanted to put that out there and see if I could get you to lean in a little bit. You're not leaning.
No, I think there's a difference between objectivity and neutrality. And this is something that a lot of journalists today, again, on both liberal and conservative sides can learn from, is that some things, you know, neutrality, being neutral between, you know, Hitler and everybody else is like, oh, well, there are two sides of the story. It's not objective. There's a difference. You have to be objectivity is what we should value, not necessarily neutrality. There aren't two sides to a lot of debates. There are some places where nuance is very important. There are other places where creationism, like these are places where nuance is virtually useless at this point because we know too much about it.
Ali, I know you got to go here, but I want to know, when you set out to write this book, what was, you know, in the elevator pitch, you know, what was the reason you wanted to write this book, and what message were you trying to get out in a nutshell?
So there are millions of closeted secularists, atheists, agnostics, humanists, freethinkers across the Muslim world who are trying to change their societies the way that Judeo-Christian societies changed theirs hundreds of years ago with the Enlightenment, and brought about all of the changes and the freedoms and the rights that all of us enjoy today. They're trying to do the same thing, but they can't publicly identify as Muslims. They can't publicly identify as atheists, because if they do, they're disowned by their families, ostracized by their communities, persecuted, put in jail. 13 countries in the world, almost the majority, punish atheism by death. The consequences for them are very dire. So they have to present themselves as Muslims. They're atheists in thought, but in presentation they're Muslims. They're living a contradictory existence. That's why the title of the book is also contradictory, to address them. And that's really what this book is about. It's bringing out that narrative that you don't hear from those people too much because they get jailed or they get hacked to death or they get executed, and they can't speak out. When I was growing up there, I promised myself that when I would be in a place where I could speak about this freely, I would. And when I announced that I was writing the book, I heard from, thousands and thousands of people across the Muslim world, from you know, Saudi Arabia to Malaysia and Egypt and Bangladesh, everywhere, telling me, you know, can you please mention this? Can you please mention this? For me, it was just something I had to do. Right. And that's why I wrote the book.
Is there something about Islam that it forces or encourages people to not speak out? And I say it within this context here in the United States, particularly, and maybe throughout the West. I think unfairly, people like to cry out and say, whenever there's a terrorist attack, how come there aren't Muslims out there gathering in the streets and denouncing this? I want to hear it denounced. And I think that's not fair at all. Position
and I find
to,
myself saying that.
Right. So, I mean, but is that part and parcel of being a good Muslim is not speaking out on issues?
Is it not speaking or speaking out?
Yeah. Is being quiet. Is it kind of part of the deal where you're not vocal. You don't really have the right of assembly in some of these places. So they're just not used to getting together, marching, being loud.
First of all, I think more recently since ISIS has come out, people have, and even before that, people have, a lot of Muslims, especially in the West, in the US and in Canada, have come out. They've started talking about it a lot more. They have started vocally denouncing it. There are imams at mosques. There are people who've gotten together. There's a Muslim reform movement. There are many groups that have come out and they started writing op-eds. Appeared on TV and various media platforms to denounce all of this stuff. Where the confusion happens is, you have a terrorist attack, ISIS beheads a guy, they quote the Quran. The Quran says to behead disbelievers, and like in Surah 8, for instance, who oppose Allah and his messenger, which is what they think the infidels are doing. When they do this, they quote the Quran. Your Muslim neighbor here in New Jersey, for instance, says that, no, this isn't right. This isn't Islam. They're misrepresenting us. They've hijacked our religion. This has nothing to do with Islam. It's not my faith. I denounce this wholeheartedly. You go and you Google the verse and you're like, well, you know, this is what it says in the book. Do you think this book is the word of God? And he's like, yeah, well, you know, that is the word of God, but it's just been misinterpreted. And that's very confusing for non-Muslims. It's very confusing. It makes it harder to make the distinction. And then you wonder if these moderate Muslims are deep inside. They're not just all ticking time bombs. Well, they aren't ticking time bombs. They just were born into a family where their parents told them that this is God. This is what you have to do. Don't steal. Don't kill. The same thing Christians are told. And now they're growing up and they're looking around and they're seeing that all these people are doing the same thing in their faith's name. And they're also confused. And so are the non-Muslims. And there is overall just a lot of confusion about this. And the reason it's there is because Muslim as an identity is very different from Islam, the religion. And that really applies to a lot of Christians. A lot of Christians say, you know, I'm a Christian. And, you know, do you believe in the Bible? Yeah, I believe in the Bible. It's a sacred book. And I'm like, well, you know what it says about gay people? It's like, yeah, but that was this. It was the Old Testament, even the New Testament. And then they go and they start justifying it because they're not getting their morality from these books. They're using their secular morality to interpret these books and to twist them and do all these intellectual acrobatics and mental gymnastics to get it to mean something that feels palatable to them. And that's really the same thing that a lot of Muslims are doing. There's still a lot of problems. There are a lot of crazies out there, and we all know that. But the only way to get around this confusion is to talk about it. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's why, you know, you mentioned Sarah Hayter. That's why she's doing what she's doing. That's why Maryam Namazi is doing what she's doing. That's why Raif Badawi, the Bangladeshi bloggers, all of us are out here and we're talking.
Great.
Sweet. So with your podcast, The Secular Jihadist, get that at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever fine audio is served?
Absolutely. You can get it everywhere you want. We have an episode with Majid Nawaz, who's the famous reform Muslim who wrote the book with Sam Harris called Islam and the Future of Tolerance, an excellent book. Our latest episode is with him, and we interviewed him. We had a fantastic conversation, so do check that out. Secular Jihadists in the Middle East. Yeah.
Cool. And of course, we can get your book at theatheistmuslim.com. And any other plugs you got? Any events, speaking? You going to be on Bill Maher's show? What's coming up?
I'm going to be speaking at the University of Toronto with Sarah Hayder and Mohammed Syed from the Ex-Muslims of North America on September 21st. That's Thursday. There's information about that online. You can just kind of Google it. I'll also be speaking in Ohio for the Center for Inquiry on September 29th. Those are the ones this month. There's a bunch of stuff in October. I'll also be coming to Australia and New Zealand in March for a two-week tour. And I will announce, I'll give more details about that later. All this stuff will go up on the website very soon. So if you're interested in coming out and having this conversation, asking a few questions, you're interested in the topic, go out, get the book, listen to the podcast, and come out to the event. All of us are doing them.
Rock on, man. Jones, are you done with The Witness?
Yeah. I am done with The Witness. Ali, thank you,
you
so
rocked.
Much for coming on.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And, I appreciate your patience as I try to navigate these waters here. Obviously, you're so much more well-versed than me in this topic, but that's why we have you on.
Well, you know, you asked a lot of good questions, and I am feeling good. I do feel a little bit of kinship with the whole Catholic thing. Yeah,
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And hey, my second favorite team in the NHL is the Toronto Maple Leafs. So
true.
I don't know where you stand. Right. So maybe there's an additional kinship there as well.
I'm down. I love the Leafs. I'm not a huge sports guy, but I do like the Leafs. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Well, hey, I think you guys might get it. You guys may get a cup in the next 2-3 years here.
Wow. Huge news on this show.
That's my prediction. I've been telling everybody that I know from Toronto, I've been telling them that. I'm like, you watch 2-3 years. I think you guys are grabbing a cup. You guys have too much young talent not to do it.
The Mike Babcock effect, finally. That would be huge
news.
Ali, you're lovely. Have a great night. We really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me on.